So I spoke or testified in front of both the, well, I guess in writing in front of the House and both in writing and orally in front of the Senate. And both testimonies were in support of proposed bills to have the state play a larger role in dealing with domestic terrorism. I supported those bills for a few reasons. The first is that we collect a lot of data on terrorism in the United States at START, and the plurality of terrorist attacks are attacks perpetrated by individuals who espouse white supremacist ideologies in the United States in most years. And often they're the majority of attacks, not just the plurality. And yet we allocate many fewer resources to domestic terrorism than we do international terrorism. So one, there's a very straightforward reason to shift resource allocation. That is even more so when you consider hate crimes as ideologically motivated violence. So in the United States, in a given year, we may have between 60 and 70 terrorist attacks, but we may have between 8 and 9,000 hate crimes. And the motivations driving hate crimes are very, very similar, if not identical, to the motivations that drive domestic terrorism. We have a data set on the perpetrators of hate crimes in the United States. It's a representative sample, it's not comprehensive. But in our sample, about 90% of the perpetrators are motivated by a combination of white supremacist motivations or gender identity or misogynistic motivations. So a male supremacy kind of agenda. And there's a lot of overlap between white supremacy and male supremacy. Both are hierarchical kinds of ideologies that espouse this idea that certain people are, should have greater privilege in society compared to others.
What are you seeing when it comes to trending, increasing, decreasing, steady? I mean, I think you've already pointed out that there is a significant occurrence of this kind of activity, but what do your numbers tell you about what's been taking place in the last couple of years?
In the last couple of years, domestic terrorist attacks are on the rise, generally speaking, compared to, several years before that. But it's kind of a tricky question because it really depends on when you start your analysis. There are re really, I think, the best way to think about domestic terrorism in the United States is that it's cyclical. There are these waves followed by government crackdowns, and then the waves subside, and then they peak again. And then there's crackdowns, and then the waves subside. And so, really, I think it's there are these sensational acts which capture our attention, which force some sort of temporary government prioritization. But those efforts then usually subside when our political memory subside or wanes. And so, what we're seeing right now is one of these peaks, followed by or in the midst of a government crackdown after the 6th January insurrection. But what I'd like to see is a more sustained investment and the inclusion of hate crimes in the resource allocation decisions that governments, including the state of Maryland, should make, because we systematically underemphasize the victims of hate crime, even though, again, they're the victims of ideologically motivated violence that is very, very similar, if not identical, to that motivating terrorism.
When you look at what took place on the 6th of January at the U.S. Capitol and some of the, I guess, media reporting leading up to that forecast or sort of telegraph that was coming, do you get the sense that governments were doing all they could to make sure something like that didn't happen?
No, government was not doing all that it could. There are real challenges associated with preventing domestic violent extremism based on constitutional protections, and we hold those constitutional protections dear: freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And so there are some reasons why it's hard to prevent domestic violent extremism from occurring, and our data actually would support that. And this is an important finding. We find that less than 25% of international terrorist attacks that are intended to kill or injure somebody succeed in killing or injuring somebody, but over 60% of domestic violent plots succeed in killing or injuring someone. And this is because we have fewer criminal justice tools to disrupt mobilizing violence before it happens, because a lot of those facets of mobilization are again constitutionally protected. So I don't want to say that it's easy to disrupt domestic violent extremist mobilization to violence, but there are other reasons beyond just our constitutional protections why we don't focus on this issue. We often don't have the political appetite to crack down on domestic violent extremism. We often have sort of bureaucratic challenges which follow from legal differences between international and domestic terrorism. But those bureaucratic decisions that we make are choices, right? So for example, the FBI's criminal division investigates hate crime. The FBI's counterterrorism division investigates terrorism. And there are a lot more resources on the international terrorism side than the domestic side. And some of that, again, is legal, but some of those are choices that we make. So it's clear that we didn't do enough before 6 January. I personally gave multiple talks to law enforcement at the federal, state, local level, as well as other audiences in the private sector, forecasting violence around the US election months before it happened. And it's not because we're particularly clever, it's because the writing was on the wall that there was this powder keg likely to go off under the pressure of our political electoral season. So I think more could have been done. And we're obviously seeing what it looks like when the Department of Justice and the FBI prioritizes this issue after the fact, after crimes occur. Our Justice Department is exceptionally good at pursuing prosecutions, but clearly that there is a reason to think that that's not an ideal outcome. That something really terrible has to happen in order for us to mobilize to then pursue prosecutions. We have to get better at prevention. And this was actually a part of the testimony before the Maryland delegation. I recommend that we invest in a public health approach to violence prevention in the United States that is more sustainable, that's less securitized. It's about empowering individuals, families, and communities to diminish the attractiveness of violent extremism, and then to diminish the impact of it when it does occur, okay. Because it will. Right, the KKK is 155 years old in this country. Al-Qaeda is 33 years old. Violent extremist movements last a very long time. And so we have to invest in both prevention and resilience as much as we invest in disruption, right? But if we only invest in disruption, that's a fairly irrational way to mitigate risk to public safety.
Okay, one last brief question for a brief answer. What did you learn from January 6th, and how can that help you in your research?
January 6th highlighted how complicated it is to disentangle domestic terrorism from spontaneous acts of criminality in support of an ideological goal, from peaceful protest and legal protest. I think it's really important for us to recognize that criminal violent extremists are not always engaging in violence to support some really extreme idea. They're often engaging in violence to support ideas that other Americans hold dear. And so we can't just treat them as someone else, as this other, this extreme fringe minority. They're often acting violently on behalf of things that you or I or our neighbors might agree with and strongly support. And so that means we have to really get into communities to address this. It's not just a fringe phenomenon.
William Braniff, director of the START program at the University of Maryland. JJ Green, WTOP News.